Doogie.
Sam.
Our mission this week is simple. We are going to discuss, determine, and then answer the question. Are Brighton any good?
How do we stop Brighton? I'm being deadly serious here.
It's Jota Silva. Could he make it? Yes, he's got it for Nottingham Forest. How about that? Nottingham Forest, 7 goals this afternoon.
After losing 7-0, how have these unique tactics helped Brighton win 4 Premier League games in a row?
Brilliant touch from Mitoma, and a brilliant finish! Out of the top drawer by Karu Mitoma.
The touch is as good as anything you will see in the Premier League this season.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of The Truth. I am your host, Sam Tai. Joining me in the studio...
We're back.
Doogie Critchley. Hello, Doogie.
Hello, Sam. Great to be here. I've had a kind of crazy weekend, so it's nice to be on terra firma, back in the studio after 1 week recording from home. I did a crazy thing at the weekend. One of my best friends was marrying a Kenyan woman, and I went from Thursday night flight till Monday morning to Kenya. So 72 hours or so, and it was epic. It was a great experience, but it was slightly knackering. And I was slightly out of the football loop until a pretty intense day today, but I'm glad to be back in it with you.
Yeah, you went on holiday recently and then you went on holiday again.
The back-to-back, which is why I couldn't go for very long. I don't have very much holiday left.
For sure.
It wasn't the greenest thing I've ever done, but I like when weddings abroad have a meaning behind it. And he was marrying a Kenyan woman. And I think that's
I think
special.
It's more than fair for you to go to that wedding. Yeah. Well, I'm sad to inform you that while you were in Kenya, you missed the British summer. It was 3 days at about 16 degrees. It was glorious, but now it's over.
Did you go full Brit? Did you have your top off, the works?
Yes, in my garden, yeah, so no one could see me. Absolutely. And, well, I'm starting to feel like I'm hanging out with two Jack Collinses these days, the amount of air miles you're clocking up, because Jack's rarely in the country either.
I was in the country this weekend, yeah. which is rare. You're absolutely right. Thankfully, it's only a couple more weeks before I'm jetting off again. So I'll be in Malaga by the end of the month and I'll feel a whole lot better about everything. But I'm jealous of your travels, Diggy. They sound amazing.
And how are you, Jack?
Yeah, I'm all right, mate. I'm all right. I can't complain. Nothing's coming up my way at the moment. Ireland got battered in the Six Nations by France at the weekend. I've had a very, very tough day. First day at Cheltenham races. Doogie's just giving me almost PTSD by mentioning the words terra firma. That was a horse that lost for me today. So that's good. Fantastic. But apart from that, I'm hunky-dory, mate. I'm all good.
What are the chances? Yeah, it's a Tuesday, so Jack's struggling at Cheltenham. Doogie's looking forward to Sunderland against Preston tonight, and I am looking forward to Villa tomorrow. I finally got myself a ticket to a Champions League game. I gave my tickets up for Bayern earlier in the year to a friend. I shouldn't have done that. That was like one of the most famous nights in the club's history.
Biggest regret of your life?
Oh, easily.
Really?
Easily, yeah, mm-hmm. For sure. Should not have done that nice deed. Certainly hasn't come around to benefit me yet either. I'm still waiting on that one. But after failing to get a couple other tickets, I am going to the second leg of Club Brugge. So I'm very excited to go and watch handsome Marco Asensio play football in the flesh. I will either be delighted at a nice cruise control victory or witness one of the greatest collapses of modern Champions League history.
It could be shorter next week.
So we will see. But for now, I am full of optimism. On the subject of Champions League, there are somewhere between 7 and 9 Premier League teams right now who think they've got a shot at securing it, courtesy of the 5 Champions League spots we expect the Premier League to yield this season. One of those teams is Brighton, who we are discussing today. And Doogie, I will start here. When I sent you the subject, Are Brighton Good? Or How Good Are Brighton? However I titled it, what was your reaction? Do you actually understand why this question was kind of humming through my brain?
It took me a second, but yes, having done a little bit of research, I think you can quite clearly divide Brighton's season almost into 3 parts. They've all been quite contrasting. And I think it's a good time to take stock of them as well. You know, as you said, there's not that long to go of this Premier League season.
Home stretch.
10 games to go.
10 to go.
And Brighton sit 7th, as you mentioned, but they are only 3 points off 4th. And given the title race is done, given relegation is all but done, the race for Europe is really the only fascinating part of this season, which I think has been really entertaining in lots of parts, but maybe hasn't had the drama right to the end that we were hoping for. And only Liverpool, with 24, have picked up more points than Brighton in 2025. They've picked up 19 in 9 games, which is level with their rivals, Crystal Palace, who have also been on an unbelievable run. But they were 4th after 13 games. but they dropped to 10th by the turn of the year. So it really was quite a dramatic downturn.
They spent quite a lot of time in 10th as well.
They did.
They were actually around there for about 3 months. Somewhere between December and the end of February, they were about 10th.
For sure.
And kind of everyone was like, well, Brighton are going to finish 10th. And now they've just surged upwards.
And quite interestingly as well, they've still got games against City. They've got games against Villa. They've got games against Newcastle to come, who are all in that discussion. So there's a lot of opportunity for them to damage their rivals. I say rivals for this top four race. Palace are not in that just yet for Champions League football. Let's see what happens next year. But there is a lot of opportunity for Brighton to secure top four, top five, which would be a phenomenal achievement. Because, Sam, there has been a kind of crazy story in Brighton. I think now we're so far into that story, given the fact it's sort of 6-7 years of it, that people kind of take it for granted where Brighton have been in the past.
Yeah, I agree with that. When I say I'm struggling to put my finger on if they're any good or are they good, etc., what I'm asking there is, are they a top six team or a top 10 team? The question is not extending to, you know, are they anything below that? And sometimes it's good to just take stock of that and realise that, wow, what an incredible journey they've been on, and look at the progress they've made, because they were only promoted in 2017. And those first couple of years in the league were pretty sufferball-esque, weren't they? It was Chris Hughton and it was very dogged stuff.
Glenn Murray.
They were nothing like what we see today. It was only after a couple of years of Chris Hughton stabilising in the Premier League, which I'm not going to criticise, because there are, well, 2 years in a row, it looks like the promoted teams are going to go down. And they give an arm and a leg for a Chris Hughton stabilising season, let's put it that way. So it was the right thing to do. And then after a couple of years, they timed it right. They moved into Graham Potter and they tried to establish a more in-possession play. And then they've obviously moved on from there. They've gone through De Zerbi. And they've just kind of hit the jets this season. They've made some huge sales. The Premier League is littered with ex-Brighton players who cost loads of money. The transfer work has been fascinating. The football has been extreme at points, but very good. But all in the space of 8 years, they have managed to produce this. And it is genuinely incredible.
Yeah, it's been an unbelievable turnaround. You know, as you say, 15th, 17th, 15th, 16th in their first 4 years in the Premier League. But since then, 9th, 6th, 11th in the last three seasons. They've reached an FA Cup semi-final in 22-23 before losing on penalties to Man United. They reached the Europa League last 16 last year before losing to Roma, anyone that's followed me on Twitter was a disaster for me, because a few years ago, I was involved in a viral clip which was taken way out of context. It was a jokey conversation at the end of a very long show where we discussed where Brighton would finish in Serie A. And the hypothesis was, would Brighton win Serie A, which was how the video was titled. We kind of settled on no, they wouldn't, but by then the damage was done. And so Roma fans, Serie A fans, delighted in tagging me in that scoreline for about 6 months after that. But either way, they lost to Roma. But prior to that, they had topped a group with Ajax and Marseille. They beat Ajax home and away. Now, Ajax last year were a bit of a car crash, but still amazing times for a club like Brighton. And in the season, they were promoted to the Premier League, to sort of put it in a little bit of context. So in 2016-17, they spent just over £7 million. This summer, they spent £235 million. And that was allowed and able to happen by the fact they had signed and sold so successfully over the last few years. Just to list some of the players that have been through at Brighton, I think is worth noting for sure. Ben White, Dan Byrne, Victor Yorkerez, obviously a miss for them, but
yep,
a rare miss. Cucurella, Bissouma, Trossard, Caicedo, McAllister, Robert Sanchez, Undav, Gilmore and Pascal Gross are probably the most prominent players. Some of those players haven't performed nearly as well at their next clubs, but they've been sold so effectively by Brighton. You know, Cucurella in particular, Caicedo going for a Premier League record fee.
British record, 115 million.
For sure. And yeah, like even considerable sums spent on Trossard and Bissouma now just pale in comparison to some of those monster fees. So they've been run so effectively. They've consistently turned over managers. They've lost managers in Graham Potter. They've lost sporting directors to Chelsea often. They've lost players to Chelsea.
Half their staff to Chelsea.
And other places as well. And it set up, Sam, what was a kind of crazy summer, but it does need the context of what happened before.
Yeah, I mean, basically, they spent an absolute ton of money. It was like double the amount they've ever spent in one transfer window. And usually, you know, clubs are quite quick to try to control the PR around that, and they try to say, well, look, you know, we sold, you know, these players, so, you know, look at net spend, all that stuff. I like the fact that Brighton really owned the fact that they just spent a lot of money. And there was an interview with their owner recently. He was just like, I think it was just time to spend a bit of money. Like, he didn't sit there and be like, well, you know, if you think about net spend, you didn't, oh, you know. Look, they just sold Caicedo recently for 115 million. They sold Alexis for 35 to 40. White was 50 odd. They'd made money from European adventures, from high placing in the Premier League, and from player sales. At some point, you got to spend that cash. And yeah, like, it felt like in a summer where almost the entire Premier League was being very mindful about PSR constraints, Brighton were like, you do realise we're like 300 million in the green here. Like, let's just go for it. And I wonder if that played into the fact that they were able to access a kind of level of footballer for a certain price range that they maybe would not have been able to do in the past. And what we have noted is that Brighton, over the years, like, they've stopped spending 5 million or 8 million on like Caicedo or Sarmiento or Enciso, and they started spending 25, 30 million on Carlos Baleba or Matt O'Reilly or Kadiolu. And even this summer, Jorginho Rutter, who was more like 35 to 40 million. They've kind of moved up a notch, haven't they? The bracket has shifted, and it's because they make so much money, they get to spend more money.
I did think it was interesting that I've also seen this interview with Paul Barber, and he basically was like, that was the high watermark for us. The high watermark for us was the Jorginho Rutter transfer. And I was looking at it going, no, it isn't. No, it isn't. Now, that doesn't mean that Brighton are going to go out and spend 70-odd million on a player anytime soon, because I don't think they will. But and when you proposed this question, Sam, what I thought was maybe the interesting part of it all, and the actual bit that you kind of dig into here, was actually maybe is the question, not are Brighton good, because Brighton are good, right? Yes, they've been streaky all season, and we can discuss the kind of ins and outs of that whenever we want. But is it, can Brighton sustain being this good? Because if they continue to buy players in, sell them for, you know, higher fees than they're buying them for, continue to make revenue from finishing high in the Premier League, from getting into European competition, there's no reason that this model can't continue. There's no reason that they can't build a team that means that they can, you know, stick around in these areas, be competitive for European football on a kind of for a while at the very least. I'm not saying they're going to be here in 25 years. I don't think anyone's trying to say that that's what's going on here, or even that we could ever predict who's going to be where. Imagine trying to predict where Manchester United were going to be 15 years ago. Wow. But like, the point being that if you can get into this sustainable model and you can continue to think about your transfers wisely, they have done with most of them, think about your managerial appointments wisely, as they have done again here, I think that there is a space for a club being this clever to continue, because they've put themselves on such good foundations that they can continue to invest without worrying about not being sustainable.
Yeah, I mean, if you do bring in that amount of money, it allows you to take some shots. And it also allows, if you're in a very stable position, it allows you to buy players with an eye on a year's time. Something that we used to talk about on ranks as redshirting players, which is like, you'll be good in a year, we'll buy you now, you'll be good in a year. And they kind of did that with Carlos Baleba a little bit. Like, he played some football last year, but he was introducing himself to the league. Now he's exploded.
Van Hekker is the one, like, that steps out. You know, how good has he been this season? Yeah. And we were talking about him on the ranks post box earlier in the week. But, you know, the fact that he came in from NAC Breda, I think it was, then they sent him out on loan to Heerenveen, then they sent him out on loan to Blackburn, and then they softly embedded him into the team. And suddenly you're like, well, he's come from nowhere. And the question actually on the post box was, Why do more people not speak about Van Hekker as one of the best in the league at the moment? And I think the answer is because he kind of just slipped in quietly, and everyone was like, "Ah, that guy's got 70 Premier League appearances," and I just didn't really pay any attention.
Agreed. Yeah, he was so under the radar that for the last 2 years in a row, I've written mini player profiles for the Brighton Official Annual. That silly book you get like in your Christmas stocking. So my work has been in that for some reason. I don't know how I ended up with that gig, but I did. And I had to write 60 words on each player each season. And honestly, for the life of me, I couldn't work out what to say about Jan Paul Hekker. I just was like, he is just, he exists. He is just there. And he's pretty good on the ball. And then suddenly this season, you're like, actually, defensively, you are 10 times as good as you were, and you're still really good on the ball. And all of a sudden, it's all sort of coming together. And he's probably the most improved player in this team. But back onto the more specific kind of like 1 year in advance system, presumably that's what they've got in mind for Brian Gruder here, who, okay, he, Kadiolu, O'Reilly, actually quite a few of these players have had injury problems and it has stopped them from integrating as quickly as they would probably want. But for a club like Brighton, who have such a stable base, that doesn't actually matter too much because it probably just means that the intended window for them, which would have been next season, it just means they're all set and ready to go anyway. They don't lose too much from that perspective, which is great. And again, they don't have any worries on PSR. A flop, in inverted commas here, after a year doesn't mean they need to start shifting players because they have no issues. They were one of the teams that were able to take advantage of PSR last summer, early June, like late June, I should say, really, before the June 30 deadline, because they managed to nick Minter off Newcastle. Newcastle have been furious about that all year. They couldn't do anything about it because Minter has been amazing. And if you put yourself in that position, you can take advantage of others. You know, you're not just nicking players off the continent, taking best players from Celtic and Feyenoord and all that. You're nicking the other players off Premier League teams who then end up going, oh, man. And that's what Newcastle have been doing.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's just to expand slightly on their summer business. Their total expenditure was £235 million. That's more than Man United have ever spent in a season. It's quite nuts how much they did spend. It was the most in the world, including Saudi Arabia. It was a lot of money.
Yeah.
But as you say, if you're buying players between £40 and £25 million, you need two, three of those to turn into £60-70 million players, and you've kind of prevented any kind of loss. And you look at them in the moment, and Ruter, Minter, Mats Wiefer has been really unfortunate with injury as well. I was probably expecting a little bit more from him, but Gruder, Kadioglu, O'Reilly, they all cost at least £25 million, but no one more than 40. And I think all of those players would finish this season thinking, I've got settled in some cases, in Ruter and Minter's case in particular, but there's more to come as well. And they feel like they are at the right club to have an explosion at some stage in the next few years. And it seems like the sort of club where, yes, there are the occasional ups and downs, and we'll maybe get on to what they were doing just before 2025. But there's always two or three players that are ready to come into the team if something's not quite working or if they have a huge injury crisis, which is worth mentioning. Brighton players, as of the day we record this, have missed over 900 days with injuries. Second place is Spurs, and they're on 255. So the gap in terms of injury crisis, and people have talked endlessly about Arsenal's injuries and Spurs' injuries. Brighton players have missed nearly 300 more days than Spurs in second. Players that were crucial last year to their season, Solly March, amazing last year. Pascal Gross left the club, that's not injury related, but Purvis Estupinan, brilliant last year, injured. O'Reilly doing his leg within what?
15 minutes.
Yeah. It was nuts. Kadioglu as well, barely played. Gruder's had some injury issues. You know, they haven't really been able to use their players that they brought in for this huge amount of money. And I think for most clubs, with a brand new manager who's only just turned 32, with this level of expenditure and it not really coming off in their first season, you'd be panicked. And yet Brighton have risen throughout this entire season and now in such a fantastic position to qualify for some form of European football, which, given everything they've been through, it could have been a bit of a disaster, but it just hasn't materialised.
Yeah, I actually was a bit confused by the sheer number of players they bought in the summer, because it felt like they were building a Europa League squad but they weren't in. It's like they'd forgotten they weren't in the Europa League anymore. But it's turned out to be the perfect antidote to one of the worst injury crises in the Premier League that we haven't spoken about very much, because they've just done really well and they've just got so much quality to call upon that it doesn't really matter. And I do remember it took them about 15 games into the season to actually field what you would imagine is the first choice front four, which is João Pedro, Jorginho Ruter, Mitoma,
and Welbeck,
and Minter. So okay, it wasn't even with Welbeck, but it took them like 15 weeks to even get that combination on the pitch for the first time, because of issues to different people and different players. And of course, yeah, Welbeck's having a great season. That's not to say he's not in the first choice 11, but you draw up a plan in football and it just goes down the drain so quickly. It's incredible. I want to move us on to the manager that you just mentioned, Fabian Hürzeler. 31 at the time of appointment, and as you say, just turned 32.
Just turned 32.
Happy birthday.
He's in fact one day older than me.
Well, well, well.
Yeah, exactly.
Thriving.
Yeah, absolutely ways. Loving life in very different ways. But yeah, Fabian Hürsler. So right now, I'm still younger than every manager in the Premier League, which is still something to,
wow,
to cling on to.
You are holding on to that by the thread. Oh my God. Fantastic. Look, he was a big story, and it was a big moment in the summer when he was appointed because of his age, basically. Like, this is, we're getting used to the idea of young managers, but even Nagelsmann was like, you know, mid-30s by the time he got a really big job beyond Hoffenheim. 31 is like...
crazy.
Is ridiculous. You know, it's so young. And as a result, there was a lot of attention and a lot of pressure, I think, on him. How do you think he's handled it, and what have you made of him?
I think his backstory is really fascinating because he hasn't even been managing for particularly long at the top level. So, of course, given his age, that doesn't really surprise you. But I think it was only 18 months at St. Pauli. He won 36 of 55 games there. He won 13 of his first 17 matches after taking over mid-season, and he took them from 15th to 5th. This is the year before last. Last year, they were promoted as champions, but not by much. They only beat Holstein Kiel by 1 point across the league. So this is a guy who's had a great 18 months, but St. Pauli is not a hugely pressurised environment compared to the Premier League, of course. And he is younger than Veltman, he is younger than Dunk, he is younger than Welbeck, Steele and Milner, of course. He was actually only 9 when James Milner made his debut for Leeds,
God,
which is insane. So yeah, there's quite a considerable gap in terms of life experience, footballing experience between your most experienced player in James Milner, who is by all accounts just the consummate professional. I'm not saying that he's going to have any issue taking orders from someone that much younger, but I think it is worth pointing out just how crazy that gap is. And you throw him into an environment where you've lost De Zerbi, who was an enormous character at the club in more than one way. Mm-hmm. I think it's fair to say was kind of asking for the sack by the end.
I think so. He was desperate to go.
It was kind of a bit bizarre.
I think he thought Brighton had hit their ceiling. And he was like, I'm out. I got to go. This is as far as I can take.
He must have been absolutely fuming when they spent more than anybody else in world football in the summer. He's like, hang on, what?
Yeah. What?
He dealt with all the players leaving and keeping the club competitive. But, you know, he's ended up at Marseille. It's a great move for him. But the team is also quite different to last year, I think is important to note. So their possession has gone from the fourth most in the league at about 60% to 52%, so eighth most.
Yep.
Their pass accuracy has again gone from second to eighth. Their shot per game have gone from fifth most to eighth most. Shots on target is a similar story. They've shored up slightly defensively as well. But yet, despite having far less of the ball, what I've been impressed with is their ability to still create a number of quality chances. So their XG per game has actually gone up slightly, despite having, what, a good 8% less of the ball, which is very impressive. Their XG against has gone down from 1.6 to 1.5. And what he has done really effectively, I think you've seen loads of teams in the Premier League this year have, in your case, as you know too well, awesome home form and terrible away form. Brighton have been very good at both, to be honest. They are 7th for points won at home, 8th for points won away. And there was a moment where they were in this run of 8 games without a win. That was 6 draws as they entered the match week on the 16th of January. And they've beaten Ipswich, Man United, Chelsea, Southampton, Bournemouth and Fulham since. They've also had a 1-0 defeat at home to Everton and that 7-0 defeat to Nottingham Forest.
We will be talking about that in depth very soon.
Which we should. But since then, I think the adaptation to shore up defensively has been really, really impressive. They've only conceded 3.2 XG in their last 4 games. And they've played Chelsea, they played Bournemouth and Fulham in that time. So very solid sides this season. But let's talk about the 7-0.
Hang on. Before we go there, I want to build on what you're saying there, because I think the way I would describe Hürsler in terms of his tactics and his impact is I've just been quite impressed with his ability to mix it up a bit. And Brighton were obviously pretty wedded to a slower possession-based game for, well, I guess it was 4 years. Potter and De Zerbi combined was 4 years. And so they built an entire team around, you know, careful ball circulation, 60% possession, baiting the press, centre-back studs on the ball, all that. Like they almost started that with Levi Colwill on loan there. And Pascal Gross was a huge part of this machine. And he has kept the good parts of that and ditched the bad parts. And you know what? There's that goal against Chelsea where they just thump it over the top to Mitoma, brings it down with the most perfect touch God has ever seen, and puts it in the corner. And It was
announced as goal of the month on Sunday.
And it was one pass. It was Verbruggen, wasn't it? It just smashes it over the top and Mitoma bring, like, and you know what? They've done a bit of that through Minter as well. And I have time for someone who can mix up his tactics like that. I am impressed.
Just on that, like, we talk a lot about Arne Slot, right? And we talk a lot about the fact that he's taken the best bits of some of what Klopp left, you know, the ability to turn it up to 11 and then mixed it with something a little bit calmer at times, been able to slow games down, et cetera, et cetera. And I don't want this to become about Liverpool, but we've given him so much praise for that. And obviously, Hudson is not top of the league and 15 points clear, so they're reasonable. But when you're starting from a standing start, as opposed to being in that conversation already, I think that ability has been wonderful, right? And look, he did this at Pauli. So they loved a switch ball at Pauli. They loved that kind of one fullback to the opposite winger raking passes over the top that would open things out. And they'd play those little triangles and then they'd switch it and suddenly they'd be away. They were really good at set pieces as well. And that's how he turned St. Pauli from a team who were, you know, in towards the bottom of the table when he took over. There was a reason he came in, and it was because his predecessor was sacked, and then turned them into a team that were promoted from the Zweite Bundesliga, which, as anyone who follows it will know, is not an easy task.
Quite tough, yeah. Just ask Hamburg.
Exactly. Ask their crosstown rivals how easy it is to get out. But, you know, we saw a bit of that at Pauli, and I was wondering what it was going to look like with in translation to this Brighton team, considering, as you said, how wedded they had been to kind of you know, possession-based, possession-heavy football where they like to control games like that. And I think that adaptation period, whilst not seamless, and we've seen that in the periods of the season where they haven't been quite as good, has been very, very impressive for a coach coming in and putting his first stamps on a new team.
Yeah, I agreed. A couple other things here. Have you noticed the way when he does an interview on Match of the Day and the interviewer is asking him a question, he stares at them like he wants to murder them?
He's quite intimidating.
What have all of these interviewers done?
He doesn't like VAR.
Like, he has the most intense glare, even when he likes the question, because sometimes they ask him a question, it'll be like, how good were you guys today? He'll look at them like he's going to murder them. Yeah. And he'll be like, well, I think we were great. But the look in his eyes... Good. Maybe that's how he's got James Milner under control, despite being 7 years his younger. I mean, he looks like a scary dude. And the intensity goes from personality, I think, also to the style, because he's recently talked about how he wants the fittest team in the Premier League. And did you hear this thing about the marathon runner video? Did you see that?
No.
So he's showed his squad a video of a marathon runner who basically, like, she was in big trouble as she crossed the line, right? She put absolutely everything into this race. Her name was Gabriella Anderson Scheiss. And okay. I have copied and pasted something into a document that I'd like to read you guys. This is the description of Gabriella Anderson Scheiss and her finish in the Los Angeles Marathon and the Olympics in, I believe it was 1982. With temperatures hitting nearly 30 degrees Celsius, 86 Fahrenheit, the conditions were warm for running a full marathon, which is 26.2 miles. At the time, the rules stipulated that there could only be 5 water stations and contestants could not be given water anywhere else. Gabriella missed the 5th and final station and became dehydrated as a result. The crowd gasped as she staggered onto the track, her torso twisted, her left arm limp, her right leg mostly seized. She waved away medical personnel who rushed to help her, knowing that if they touched her, she would be disqualified. While the effects of her heat exhaustion were evident, trackside medics saw that she was still perspiring, which meant her body still had some disposable fluids, so they let her continue. The LA Coliseum crowd applauded as she limped around the track in the race's final 400 metres, occasionally stopping and holding her head. It took her 5 minutes and 44 seconds to complete the last 400 metres. This woman nearly died. And Fabian Hertzler...
Like trying to find my tent in Kenya on Saturday night.
So Fabian Hertzler has shown his squad in the last couple of weeks this video of this runner and has basically said, this is what I want. Now, first of all, I would just have loved to be in the room. I just would have absolutely...
Lewis Dunn,
I just want to know exactly what João Pedro's face looks like at this point. But this is what he is asking for. So when we talk about intensity of his personality and what his demands are, apparently this is what he wants. Mm. It sounds pretty scary to me, but ultimately this is the bar he wants to set.
Yeah, absolutely. I think if you look at... So when I think about intensity of Premier League games, I think about midfield. And he's had to go without Mats Fifa, who I think is probably the best ball player in that midfield, and Pascal Gross has left, who was... unbelievable for Brighton ever since his arrival. One of the best bargains in Premier League history.
Club legend as well.
For sure. Believer's had a couple of injury issues. He's had to rely on Hinchelwood, Ayari, etc., who might well turn into excellent
players.
They've
all been okay, yeah.
I think they've there's maybe not as much quality as you'd expect from a club that's doing as well as they have in midfield. Maybe Belieber aside.
Belieber's awesome.
I think he is as well. But aside from that, in terms of real top-level quality and where they can get to. So to have this level of competence, when also there's been a clear drop-off, I would say, in Lewis Dunk in the last couple of seasons as well, from a very, very high level, yeah. It's worth saying. And this guy...
Well, he's not played the last four. Webster's been captain and
done
and
really
played
well.
Really well.
And Van Hecker, I think, has played even better on the back of playing with Webster as well. And look, I don't want to have a go at Lewis Dunk. Like, he was playing for Bognor Regis, you know, at one stage in his career. He's played in the Europa League. He was phenomenal for Brighton for a long time.
Mighty servant to the club, but the time might be done.
For sure. I would say as well. And I love the fact that despite having a lot of attacking players, some of which who I think have really elite potential, João Pedro in particular, there's not necessarily, again, similar to the midfield, I don't think there's necessarily Champions League quality on paper there. Danny Welbeck has been a phenomenal player for a number of clubs there, but his career was really drifting a few years ago, struggling at Watford. João Pedro has come through at Watford. He got moved to Brighton. Looks like he might move on at some stage.
I've got to say, I think João Pedro might be Champions League quality already.
I think he is.
And I think Jorginho is only one season away.
Do you think? Yeah. I'm less hot on Ruta than others. And I do think Matoma has been excellent at points, but maybe hasn't shown consistency enough as well. But the fact that he's got them all delivering and all not seeming to mind who starts, who comes on, who rotates, I think that's a real sign of a very good man manager, which given his age, I think is very impressive.
Agreed. I've got one more thing for you on Hertzler before we move on to the up and down nature of their season. Brighton have caught teams offside the most times in the Premier League this season. Did you know that? They have, very officially, Emily, the best offside trap. 76 offsides. They beat Villa by one.
They need to be careful. Barcelona are going to be in so quickly for Hertzler if they keep that up.
Yeah, for sure. Villa are second with 75, and Fulham are joint third with 70, joint with Liverpool.
You'll never sing that.
You might not. It's not worth singing about at all. But more fuel to the fire there to say that maybe after this season, Lewis Dunk does kind of, move off into the twilight there. That's such a horrible way of saying it. But if you're playing an aggressively high line and you are catching teams offside at a league-leading level, it is going to get harder and harder for Dunk to play in the line. And to be honest with you, Webster's been really good, but they might even look for another player. We'll have to see. Right, let's get into the meat of it here, because the results, you've kind of hinted at it at the top of the show, but they have been a bit weird. And this ultimately is why I've not been able to put my finger on Brighton all season long. They're the only team out of all 20 that by the halfway point, I genuinely just couldn't place. I mean, the fact that I write an opposition analysis programme column for Southampton means that I get a really strong look at all of them, and I watch football for a living, means I get two too. Brighton are the only ones that when I got to writing about them, I was like, I can't place them. I just can't. And fair play to them. They started day one top of the Premier League table. They beat Everton 3-0 and they were top. And it was actually a pretty decent start. So Hertzler got quite a lot of momentum. But then it sort of didn't really happen for a while, did it?
No, I think the injuries started really racking up. There were some sides at that particular moment that started going on very good runs that were competing for Europe. Man City hadn't quite had their big drop-off. Chelsea were in a great moment at that particular time as well. I think Aston Villa had a stronger start to the season
than
they currently are.
Good start of season, yeah.
And it's difficult when you're trying to find your feet in the Premier League in, you know, as I said, he's only had 18 months of management beforehand. And I think so often when clubs sign a number of players in the summer, you know, idiots like me that tweet too often say, oh, they've won the window. Often the club that signs the most players, you really don't really want to sign more than three or four players, I don't think, ideally. And you want to strengthen your first 11 each year. Signing six, seven, eight players is going to take a little while to gel. And they're going to take a while to establish their pecking order in the dressing room, how they play together, connections, combinations, etc. And it wasn't until the turn of the year when their injury crisis did start to ease a little bit. And more recently, there's been some changes in personnel as well. Belieber's come back. Dunk has been injured. I feel like I'm hammering Lewis Dunk, and I don't really want to turn into this whatsoever. But I think it has made a difference having Van Hecker alongside Webster. And also, he stopped making quite uniquely bad decisions in one-off games as well. And I think it is probably time that we talked about Nottingham Forest.
Yeah, yeah. They lost a game 7-0 this year. There is no way to spin that. For anything other than it was an absolute disaster. And
it was slightly avoidable.
And it was a very avoidable, very foreseeable disaster.
Poor old Jack Hinshelwood. Like, just, I remember looking at the lineup and thinking, And then it turned into Jack Hinshelwood effectively was Jon Snow against that charging army of cavalry. That's the only way I can describe it. That meme of him standing there with a sword.
Where he draws his
horses.
Sword.
Yeah.
If he ever gets into the media or podcasting or whatever afterwards, they are going to have to lead with, what were your thoughts on that?
Did you enjoy that?
Yeah.
The formation was wrecked.
It was nominally a 4-3-3, but it was Welbeck up front, Mitoma and Minter wide. And then the two eights, in inverted commas, were Jorginho Ruter and João Pedro, which left Hinshelwood as the six, and it was just him. And
it was the reverse Craig Levine.
And it was it was away to Forest. Forest were in a great place. Forest were no secret at this point. This is match day 24, right? We all know what Forest are at this point. And they get absolutely smacked. So 7-0. It's their heaviest league defeat since a 9-0 loss to Middlesbrough on the opening day of the 1958-59 season. And I think we can all agree that Hertzler got that one very wrong. And he admitted it himself when he made three substitutes at halftime and brought on a midfield. Now, admittedly, it actually got worse, not better. They were 3-0 down at halftime and they were 7-0 down at full-time. So they conceded more with a real midfield than they did without. But you'd imagine that's more a case of the damage is done and the momentum has swung irrevocably to one side than really anything else. But I just thought that was one of the weirdest and stupidest things that I've seen this season. And something we didn't talk about last week when we talked about Ruben Amorim, and it's the same thing, is that in about December, Man United played Newcastle, when Amorim wheeled out, and I mean wheeled out, Casemiro and Eriksen against Bruno Guimaraes, Sandro Tonali, and big Joel Linton. What did you think was going to happen?
Yeah.
And it was one of those moments again. I don't understand this stuff. And it just puts the shivers up you when you're trying to give this guy all the praise in the world. And it's like, what were you doing there?
It's probably the result that will... It's the most memorable result of their season, no matter how they finish. They'll probably finish it. They could well finish in a Champions League spot. And people will still remember this result in 4 or 5 years' time. Whereas so many other results just fade into nothingness after a season or two.
A week.
Yeah, well, exactly. I mean, that's such as the regularity of football, isn't it? I mentioned it earlier, but 3.2 XG conceded in the next four games, despite playing very high calibre of opposition. He's learned from it quickly.
He burnt the game plan. Did you read this? Afterwards, he came out and he was like, I burnt the game plan in front of my players to show them that I was taking responsibility for what happened. And I was like, wow, it feels like exercising some demons. But I think you're right, right? Like, also, I think the weird thing there is that actually, when you put it all into context, they actually started the game quite well.
Yeah, they first 10 minutes, like, they're knocking it about.
They could have been like, no, they could and maybe should have been 2-3-0 up. And then they just completely collapsed and capitulated in on themselves. And look, that's not an excuse. It's just an observation how quickly things can turn. But I think that you're right. You know, learning, going into a double pivot more often in the midfield has really helped. Like, I think Jack Hinshelwood is going to be a really good player. I really like him. And he's, you know, an academy prospect who's incredibly versatile, can play midfield, can play either fullback role. He's been really useful for this Brighton side. But they've not exposed him in the same way afterwards. And look, sometimes you have to take that with a young manager. They're going to make mistakes. And the important thing is they learn from them. And I think that what we've seen from Hertzler is like, wow, I cannot do that again. I cannot get away with that. I thought I might be able to. And ultimately, I now learn from that and we move on.
I mean, even like multiple league title winning managers like Ruben Amorim can make a mistake in midfield like that. It does happen.
I think Amorim's trying to prove a point. It might be slightly different.
Okay, yeah, maybe. Hertzler definitely wasn't trying to say he'd run out of players because he's got a fair few. But hey, everyone makes mistakes. It's about how you bounce back, and he has bounced back. You've continually referenced it, but stealing quotes from an Opta analyst piece here. They are tied with Palace for fewest XG conceded since match day 24. So pretty damn good. Mm. They scored 11 goals in their last four fixtures. Only Liverpool have scored more, and Liverpool have actually played a game more. So that's almost not even fair. And despite that ridiculous defeat, Brighton have lost the third fewest games in the Premier League this season. Just six, with only Liverpool and Arsenal losing fewer. They're on a 6-game win streak, which is kind of the reason we're talking about this, because they've rounded into form right at the time where the home stretch begins. They've recently knocked Newcastle out of the FA Cup away from home, which is a hell of a feat. Like, is it that, like, Newcastle are a ridiculously difficult team to beat. They're horrible to play against. And the fact that they managed to go to their place and do that is genuinely really, really impressive. So, in summary, not bad. But they have drawn a hell of a lot of games this year. And that is basically the reason why they have not already catapulted themselves into a position maybe like where Forest are. Brighton have drawn 10 games this year and only two teams have drawn more. It's too many draws, obviously. And it's just those little margins there that have probably cost them a little bit, which means they're playing catch up on a top five spot. I guess the question we end on here is, do you think they can do it? Can they actually vault themselves into the top five? Because they are just a handful of points away, and recently they've looked likely to beat just about anybody they come across.
I talked earlier about the fixtures they've still got to come against teams amongst them. It always slightly worries me with a club that have been through so many injuries that some of the players that have been injured are never going to quite hit the form that you'd expect them to, maybe at some stage in the season, and it's just a write-off season for them. You know, Sonny March playing 37 league minutes, Vifa starting 4 games, O'Reilly 5, Kadioglu 5, Gruder 5, Diego Gomez 1. Their new signings, bar Minta and Ruta, just haven't really been able to contribute. And I do think that catches up with you eventually. To be honest, I know this seems stupid given the fact we've just talked about Brighton for 50 minutes. I don't really care whether they make the Champions League. I think this season's incredibly impressive either way. Like last year, if you cast your minds back, they didn't know whether it was Verbruggen or Steele starting in goal. Estupinan started virtually every game at left back. He's not been fit at all. Tarek Lamptey, who was a really, really promising prospect a few years ago, hasn't been fit at all. Lewis Dunks had a huge drop off. They lost Gilmore. They lost Pascal Gross, their best probably ever Premier League player. Evan Ferguson was a real, you know, sharpshooter in the making. People talking about a £100 million move, has a huge drop-off, then gets loaned to West Ham. There has been so much chopping and changing at Brighton this season that actually to even be in this conversation at this stage with clubs that, yes, didn't spend as much as Brighton in the summer, but spent considerably more over the last 5 years in terms of net spend. You know, only Wolves and Everton have a better net spend than Brighton in the last 5 years. And that includes the summer where they, or the season, they spent £235 million. They have deserved to spend a lot of money for a long, long time. So to be in this conversation at this stage, under a 32-year-old, with all that change, I think it's pretty, pretty special.
Nice question, Dodge Doogie. Jack?
I think they can do it. Do I think they will? Probably not. And I also think it might be for the best that they don't. I think that actually a Europa League campaign with these players settling in next year could be a real one potential opportunity to go and win European silverware and really catapult yourself into the conversation. You know, look at the teams that have won the Europa League in recent years. You're talking about some of the biggest names in European football, and also some names who, you know, were a little bit quieter and are now maybe, you know, making waves. Your Atalantas, for example,
Roma.
Yeah, but you know, kind of, I think you kind of look at Atalanta and what they did, and suddenly everyone is taking them, talking about them. One, they're in a title race, fine, and maybe that's a stretch to suggest that Brighton will be in that conversation in 2 years'
well,
time.
Brighton can win Serie A, establish that.
They are in a title race, right? It's just not in England.
Just in Serie A. It's just a shame they haven't played any games, actually, maybe top. But like, when you actually put all of that in context, you're like, well, could that be the thing? Could a European trophy, European adventure, and potentially getting to the sharp end of that competition be the thing that really catapults Brighton into the mainstream consciousness? It makes them more of an attractive club than they are already to potential signings. We know that they have this cash flow going through that they're willing to sell. But like, even someone like Yasin Iyari, who I haven't mentioned very much yet, but who was brought in for a cut price fee from Sweden, and suddenly you're like, oh, he's in the team now.
He's that good
was,
as well.
It was one of those players that you know, kind of brought in, and at the time, I remember discussing it. I was working on deadline day and someone was like, what's he like? And I was like, I'll be completely honest with you, I've never seen this guy play football. I was like, but I guarantee you in 2 years he'll be absolutely unbelievable. And it's just like one of those kind of things that...
That's because they have like literally signed 15 of them. Jakub Modder and Jokeres was part of that, and Ayari. It's just like, it's players you simply haven't seen because he plays for AIK.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, you go to those, you know, those moments where those players start to settle in, and, you know, as Doogie says, I think that these new signings, you know, actually talking about those names, You know, Matt O'Reilly, who I'm a huge fan of for notable reasons, but, you know, also someone like Ferdi Kalioglu, who I think is brilliant. Mm-hmm. There are loads of players here that you're kind of going on. Gruda was unbelievable in Germany last year. When you're kind of flicking about this, there is an opportunity for all of those players to explode. I mean, look, maybe 70% of them do, because it's about 70% of players seem to succeed at Brighton. Even if that's the case, you're talking about a very, very talented squad next year. If they get Europa League football, I think they're in a really, really good place. But that doesn't mean that they can't get Champions League football. I just can't see them going and, like, winning the Champions League in the way that I could see them going and winning the Europa potentially.
No, it's wide open for five or six teams here to sneak into fourth and fifth, I think. But I probably, if pushed, wouldn't put Brighton there. I think Newcastle and Manchester City are going to do it. I think they'll be too strong. Chelsea will fall out. Bournemouth will fall off. And Villa will be so distracted by winning the Champions League.
There we go.
Well, at least you'll be in it.
Villa to win the Champions League and the FA Cup. The Cup double is 125-1, if anyone fancies a bit of free money.
There's a famous quote from, I think it's Lock, Stock and Two Smoking Barrels. And it's like, there's a reason it's 125-1, mate. It won't win.
Lies.
Jack, after your week at Cheltenham, I don't know. Go for it.
Maybe I'll stick it on.
What do you know, huh? What do you know? Okay, I think you've satisfied me, guys. I think I'm absolutely fine with the idea that Brighton are a very strong side, borderline top five when things are going their way, but probably just a little shy. There was genuinely, like, coming into this conversation, I still wasn't totally sure they weren't just the 10th best team in England before I really, really had a good think about it and a good chat about it with you guys. Because for most of this year, I've basically had them level with Fulham.
They're a really good side who are going to get better, is probably where I'd have them, right? They might not be quite Champions League quality right now, but I guarantee if they stay on this trajectory, they will be soon.
Yeah, well, that's a Jack Collins guarantee. Love they it. Never fail.
Famously.
Famously.
Unless it's on the horses.
There we go. There we go.
All right, Duke, don't worry.
Well, this is not a horse racing podcast. This is a football podcast. And it has been a pleasure. Doogie, thank you.
Thank you, Sam.
Jack, thank you.
Always a pleasure, Sam. Thank you very much.
Thank you to the listener. I hope you enjoyed it. It was a big, big old deep dive there in Brighton. Big old deep dive. Probably deeper than I thought that we would go. But when there's lots to talk about, there's lots to talk about. See you next week, guys.